Jeff Hasty, thank you for coming in today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having
me. To talk with us. we were just talking before they started rolling tape, and if we still roll tape, by the way, I don't think we're rolling tape anywhere. But you've done a lot of various things across many states over time. And why don't we just start with what you're doing now, and then we're just going to kind of backfill how we got there.
All right. So currently I'm the COO Operations Manager for Gross Mechanical here in St. Louis. We're a heavy industrial contractor. Do a lot of pipe fabrication, work in power plants, chemical plants, pharmaceutical stuff, you know, just a variety of different more your industrial type work.
Heavy meaning like literally physically heavy?
Yeah, typically we're dealing with heavier pipe systems, variety of different piping alloys. We have the largest fab shop in the St. Louis area for pipe fabrication, one of the largest in the Midwest. So,
I didn't know that. I didn't realize. I've been there, and I guess the my basis for comparison, I think, was going to Turner Industries in Paris, Texas.
Ah, yep.
So I don't have a good sense of it. And I've then been some there, been on both, like way on both sides.
Right.
But I mean, in your shop, there's a lot going on there.
There is. Yep. We can run 20 to 25 welders at a time in the shop, or 20, 25 people with, you know, half of those guys welding on turning machines, doing different types of welding for various systems and alloys and all sorts of stuff. So
do you find that Gross Mechanical is typically spooling or making parts for a specific industry that you guys sort of, are you more into like an energy side or more into a structural side or whatever needs to be built side?
Kind of whatever needs to be built. Typically, we do a lot of our own fabrication for our guys in the field to install, but we also do a lot of fabrication for other places for others to install as well. And it just really runs the gamut. You know, we do a lot of work for P66 refinery, some of the power plants, like I said, chemical plants, food grade stuff. It just depends on the need.
And that's going to be a lot of, is that AML typically with like the P66?
Yep.
Okay. I think our approved manufacturer list.
Yep.
So you've been at Gross Mechanical for how long?
Coming up to 7 months.
Okay. Seven months. Yep. And we're going to go through, this isn't your first 7 months around metal.
No, it is not.
You know, so this isn't, you're not Johnny come lately or Jeff come lately. Okay, well, let's back it up because I did go through LinkedIn, you know, and saw that you went to California State, Sacramento, yep. Made the assumption that, yeah, he's probably from California. And we started talking, and your story's a lot more interesting than I shouldn't say that because everyone who walks in here it has a story that I was totally not expecting. You just have layers of stories that are interesting. So you were born in Athens, Georgia.
Yep.
Moved to Charleston, South Carolina.
Correct.
And that seems like kind of where the story starts to pick up, and you're moving around doing different things, playing sports. So you don't have to go into super granular. I'll pull us into something if it's like, wow, we got to know more about that. But, okay, so let's pick up in South Carolina. How old are you when you get there?
Oh, I was a little kid, toddler, growing up in the Charleston area. My dad was in construction. He was a pipe fitter by trade, worked in all the heavy industrial stuff in the Charleston area. My granddad was a plumbing contractor and had his own plumbing business there. So
okay.
My dad moonlighted with him.
Okay.
Doing
plumbing
work.
Wow, it goes way back.
Yeah. Yep.
Because your dad was he born, what, like in the early 40s?
48.
48. Okay. Yep. So, and then you got granddad. So you guys covering quite a bit of time here.
Yep.
Runs sort of in the family.
It does run in the family, yes.
Okay. So you're there and you're learning about what your dad's doing growing up. And
yep.
Okay.
From there, he got into building power plants across the country. So when I was about 10 years old, we started traveling across the U.S. building power plants. He's mechanical superintendent at that point in his career. And about every 18 months, 2 years, we moved to another state and built another power plant. So
it's like the non-Army, Army brat.
Pretty much.
Okay. And you said, but just kind of to keep you guys, you've got a brother, to keep you guys sort of grounded and busy,
yep.
you guys, they'd send you back to the East Coast
yep.
to work at the marina.
Yeah,
is that right?
My aunt and uncle and my granddad was part owner of this marina on Isle of Palms right outside Charleston. And summer times, my brother and I would fly back, work at the marina, commercial fish, do whatever need to be done around there. I had another uncle that was a framing contractor in the area, worked with him building houses, worked with my granddad on the plumbing side, just kind of whatever.
It's like a lot of exposure to a lot of building.
Yes.
At a young age, and it ties into sort of your love for ocean as time goes on.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're kind of bouncing around. You're Athens, Charleston. Where did you kind of bounce around? Not to name every single one, but maybe the stops along the way.
We moved to Virginia for a while, then back to South Carolina for a little bit. We moved to Texas, Colorado, several places in California, moved all the way over to Maine.
Holy shit. You guys were all over the
California.
Place.
Yeah.
And this was all, is this all before you graduated high school?
Yeah, I graduated high school in Sacramento in 1990.
Well, I guess the good news is if there's somebody in your class you just couldn't stand, you wouldn't have got to deal with it for that long.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
But there's certainly trade-offs on the way. Is there any place that you really liked that you guys had to leave, that you were like, I kind of like this one? That was a good one.
You know, every place had its unique aspects that we really enjoyed. That was one thing I'd have to really compliment my parents about, was whatever was unique to that area, we tried to experience it.
Right. Like whatever the environment had to offer.
Yeah.
So
otherwise. We lived in Colorado through a school program. I got to learn to downhill snow ski.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved to California, a lot of winter trails and stuff for cross country skiing. So we did a lot of cross country skiing up in northern,
I've never been that tired in my life.
Yeah.
As cross country skiing at altitude.
Yep.
I mean, I'd be tired at sea level, but that's no joke.
Yep. That's a good time, though.
It is a good time. I mean, I was blacked out for most of it because there's no oxygen in my body. Did you become an adept cross-country skier? I'm not talking Olympics, but you could get around pretty well?
Yeah. Matter of fact, we got into what's called telemarking, so you're downhill skiing on cross-country skis. So that got pretty interesting.
Yeah. Every once in a while you go skiing, you see those guys.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize, what a scrub you are as a skier, when you see someone just technically traversing.
Yeah. It's like a ballet on the ski slope. It's really pretty to watch.
And I've seen, I don't know anything about telemarketing. I think you've already doubled my knowledge of it. I've seen them. I've almost run over them. But when someone's telemarketing, what are they focused? Is that just an entirely a form activity? Clearly you want to get down a mountain. I'm sure there's some sort of utility to it, historically speaking.
Right.
But is it really just about a form that you're trying to achieve?
It is. It's, just the technique of making the turns and stuff, since, downhill ski, you're all locked into your, knee-high boots and bindings that lock your heel and everything in. With cross-country skis, it's just your toe that's locked in, so you can't turn and manipulate the ski like you do downhill. So you kind of have to push one ski forward and kind of bend down in order to get the edge, and that's kind
of
makes it that
hopping.
Graceful. It is a lot of hopping, yep.
And that's where it gets... it just becomes unfamiliar very quickly if you haven't done it. You're trying to make a turn but keep speed.
Yeah.
And now you're hopping kind of diagonally.
There's a lot of crashes trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Did you ever snowboard, speaking of a lot of crashing?
When I was really skiing a lot was when snowboarding was first starting to come out.
Those guys.
And they always, every time I went by them, they were just sitting on their butts on the slope, really not doing anything. So I was like, this is kind of boring. So I never did get into it.
Yeah, that was, of our era, that was like just a hostile takeover.
Yeah, it was.
the slopes were like so peaceful and great. Every once in a while, you had some chump flying by. You always had the kids with no helmets that were going like 1,000, no poles, nothing.
Yeah.
Down the mountain, and you're like,
Yeah.
Hope they make it. But you don't get mad at them because they're literally, they have no clue.
And no fear.
Fearless.
Yeah.
And... my experience, I've never skied past that kid who wrecked. He usually makes it. Yep. You know, he's just like tips straight downhill.
Yep.
And they make it to the bottom. Thank God. But it was a hostile takeover, and we were of the age to where I grew up learning how to ski. I reached an age where I was like, if I want to get better, I was like 23. I was actually living in California, and I was like going out to Tahoe, and I was like, mm-hmm. if I want to get better, there's a really to reach the next level, and I'm not going to the Olympics, so what do I want to reach it for? But I'm probably going to hurt myself.
Yep.
You know, if I reach up for that. But so skiing was getting kind of boring because I wasn't trying. I was like playing it safe.
Right.
So I was like, maybe I'll pick up snowboarding to kind of, because I like being out here and I'll have a challenge, but I won't be trying to fly off cliffs. It'll be just as challenging, but I'm still on the ground.
Yep.
I don't know how to do it. but that was a lot of falling. It was quite a bit of falling. My wrist still hurts.
Oh, yeah.
It clicks still to today. But
yep.
Telemarking is it's just really neat to watch because it's so technical.
Yeah.
Are you good at it?
No. I haven't done it in years now. I used to be okay.
Okay. Like you get down without wiping out kind
yeah.
of thing?
Yeah.
Is it like that? Is telemarking like that where you – when you downhill ski, you're on the edge a lot. Like you right. might wipe out.
Right.
Is telemarking – is that feeling present?
Yes.
It is.
It can be. Yeah. It's not as – fast as like downhill skiing, mm-hmm. but it's a different feeling of being on the edge. But yeah, it could be
on average probably not as catastrophic.
Well, funny story, my dad, my brother and I were skiing in Maine actually, and my brother and I were downhill skiing and my dad was telemarking that day, and it was a ungroomed natural slope. And we just got a bunch of snow, and it kind of got a little wet.
Mm-hmm.
And he got off where everybody had skied and packed the snow down, and he hit some, like, really wet snow.
Yeah.
And he just came to an abrupt stop. And, like, with his heels unlocked, his face went right between the two skis. And he just face planted. And he had a big beard at the time. And first I was like, oh, shit. I think my dad's dead, you know, because he wasn't
that
moving.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he hit pretty hard. And then I see him start moving, chuckling, and then he kind of gets up and his face is
all
full
Santa
of snow.
All Santa Claus
yeah.
up. So. You're like relief and laughter all at one
yeah.
time.
Yeah, it was a memorable experience.
Yeah, when you see your dad like really eat it,
yeah,
it's something else. Like you're, it doesn't happen, you know, they've already hurt themselves so many times by the time you're starting to remember things. It doesn't happen as much.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're tired of fucking themselves up. So they start kind of laying up. So when you see something like that happen, it kind of knocks the wind out of you a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he was okay and everything.
Oh, yeah. There's many more crashes with him after that. But
so you're out. So you guys are enjoying the environments that you're in. So
yeah.
Your parents, nothing's really sticking out. You just kind of made the best of it. But you guys jumped in and jumped out.
Yeah, I mean, it really was like that, you know. And Maine was absolutely beautiful. We were up in the middle northern part
I've
of Maine.
I've never been there. Mm-mm.
There was, I mean, you could literally get on snowmobile trails and go for miles and never cross another paved road, you know. We had a friend that had a cabin on a lake up there, and from her cabin, you could go into Canada several hundred miles and never cross a paved road.
Really?
Yeah.
I bet you a good bit of it's still like that.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, Maine is – I mean, this is very Missouri-centric, but it feels like so far away. I mean, it is far away. I mean, it's a bit of a hike. So you end up going to college. So you graduate high school.
Yep.
You told me you were a football player.
Yep.
And what'd you play? What positions were you?
Running back, alternated tailback, fullback, and then strong safety on defense.
What offense were you guys running? T-full house, wishbone – power eye,
more of a power eye.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, is what we ran, but yeah.
And that was out in California.
Yeah, that was Sacramento area.
How was the talent out there during your era? Was it? What I mean, the California, Texas, these different places typically have like.
Our conference was fairly competitive. I can't say we had a lot of NFL level players come out of there, but
yeah,
there were some good talent in there.
Enough to keep you on your toes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. You know, any good hits you remember?
On me?
No, well, you play. Let's take the on the free safety side.
That was strong safety.
Strong safety.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, that was
Your job. Guys, you're not even looking.
Yeah, you're the hitman. You know, so
that's a fabulous position.
Yeah, there's too many of those to count.
But. Well, it's great because you know linebacker, you're really in a lot of traffic.
Right.
So you don't get sort of that sort of bird's eye like there he is.
Yeah.
And just heat seeking missile.
Yeah.
It's just like right in the ear hole.
Yep.
They never saw it coming.
Yep. That was the fun part of strong safety.
And that was an era when doing that, there was nothing wrong with it.
Oh, no.
The coaches were like, good hit.
It was encouraged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm reckon hung up on CTE, but I will say that was not much of a concern then.
No.
You know, like I only got my bell rung four times that game. It was great.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the whole second half.
Yeah, exactly right.
It was fun, though. Yeah.
Can't move the next day.
Hell no.
Yeah.
Especially when somebody give you like a good clip right in the back or something and you're all messed up. Did you want to play college football or you kind of had enough? And
I did actually for.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, for Sac State for a brief period of time.
Yeah. And how was that? Was that a big step up? I mean, most people that end up going to play college football realize it questions their actual love for the sport.
That's kind of what it became. It was not fun anymore. Yes. It was more of a job. And then you start looking at it and you're going, I'm not going to go to the NFL. So why the hell am I doing this to my body? You know, why am I taking these shots and concussing myself? And so.
Yeah. And the guys who do it love the sport.
Yeah. And I absolutely loved it. But at some point.
They like double love it.
Yeah.
I loved hitting and stuff like that, but there's something different happening there.
Yes, there is.
You know?
Yep.
Or it's a non-option for them where their parents are, you know, maybe like, it's just not even an option to even if they're not on scholarship, they're like, you're playing football.
Right.
You know? But I had the same thing, which was playing in college, and I was just like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Literally.
Yep.
What am I doing right now?
Yep. Exactly right.
So you hung up the cleats.
I did.
And what'd you do? So what'd you study undergrad?
Well, I was studying business at the time. I was in law enforcement. My goal at that time, as I was getting into law enforcement about that time, was to be a chief of police somewhere at some point. So a lot of my studying was towards city management, that kind of thing.
Okay. And there was a time when you were looking into the vet stuff?
Yes, that was prior to coming out of high school.
Oh, it was? It was early?
Yeah, it was like I always wanted to be a vet, as far as I can remember.
What? Do you remember why?
Combination of a couple of things. One, we grew up in the country, even though we're in the Charleston area, out in the country, around a lot of farm animals. My dad was studying to be a veterinarian. That's when I was born in Athens. He was going to the University of Georgia studying veterinary medicine. So I remember him having his old Merrick manuals and stuff from veterinary stuff, school that, you know, I would read and just kind of really intrigued me.
Kind of inspired you, yeah.
Yeah, so that was my goal into high school. Then I worked for a veterinarian for a little while and had a bad taste in my mouth, so I pivoted.
So they we don't have to go into details because it's a memory that made you pivot. But basically, you guys had a disagreement on the approach. What's your role here and how do you do it? Meaning that maybe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe ethical issues or differences?
In my opinion, there were some definite ethical issues on some of the treatment around animals. So specific to euthanasia, but yeah.
Yeah. And that experience, it sort of tainted it for you.
Completely tainted it, yeah.
Because you knew that this isn't the only guy probably doing this.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't the guy up at PetSmart all the time.
Right.
You know, who's hanging out with Spot.
Right.
Okay. So these were big animals or?
Dogs, cats.
Okay. You know. So like a family vet.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of those things where I mean, I've had to put down dogs in my past, which is, if you ask me, were like my two worst days. It's like those 2 days.
Agreed.
I mean, cried like a baby.
Agreed.
Both times.
Yep.
And they come in, they're like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, what I want right now is for you to fucking leave this room because this is the worst day of my life and you're interrupting my good cry.
Yep.
Okay. I'm trying to put some closure here. But it's one of those things that's like, I don't really even want to know what happens after this point. Okay. We've got this dog who's been euthanized and I don't want to know what happens. I'm going to leave the building. I'm going to find a really cute puppy so I start to forget about this puppy. You know, but it's a truly, you know, I have friends that are vets and actually two and one of them went through all the trouble to become a vet. And, you know, he also has a, you know, like he want to have a family, do all that stuff when we're younger. He actually did a lot. So we graduated college together. He hadn't taken the proper prereqs to be a vet, but he wanted to be one. So he went back, I think he went to Auburn to take all those prereqs. So he took a couple of years out of his life to do that. And then he goes to vet school. And 5 years after, he's like, this is not an easy way to make a living.
No, it's not.
He's like, this is, as much as I love it, I have, you know, different goals and these things don't align.
Yep.
So he had to hang up the stethoscope and move on to other things. And one other person had, you know, they were part of the family that was owning the vet clinics. So at least they've kind of come into an, there was a path to an ownership stake, you know, which is a slightly different deal.
Yeah, that's very different.
So all that to say, not ending up a vet is, you know, two of the people I know, one decided after all of that not to do it.
Yeah. That's, yeah. That was kind of my dad. He was in vet school and was getting to the point of, you know, he'd done all his prerequisite work and was getting into the, you know, actual medical side of it. And he was, started talking to some people and he's, I'm only going to make this much money being a vet. You know, at that time that was in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, I can go make more money doing construction work. So that's what led him into what he was doing.
It was probably less of the emotional roller coaster that being a vet. I mean, I know they probably become hardened over time.
Yeah.
Or else they couldn't do it.
Right.
It's just too damn sad.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you unfortunately, I guess it's fortunate that you learned when you learned because you didn't get too far down the path.
Yeah. I'm glad I figured it out when I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had to attack at that point.
Yes.
So where'd you go? So now you're going to college, I guess now. Did that experience occur in college?
That experience occurred before college. And that time, as I started into college, I was just taking prerequisites.
Yep.
It's when a friend of mine was in law enforcement, said, you'd be really good at this. So I went and tested that out. And
when they said you'd be, like, what were they seeing?
I think personality was, like, her biggest driving factor.
Okay.
Behind it. It takes a certain skill to do that job, you know.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm thinking that otherwise a good person, but also possesses the intensity when needed to do it.
Yeah. And the ability to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the key in any of this is being able to communicate with people and at various levels. I mean, sometimes you're talking to homeless people on the street with, you know, no education, and then the next call you're talking to a doctor, you know, somewhere. So you have to be able to translate your ability to communicate with people to levels that they understand. So,
okay. And is that just something? Had you thought of that about yourself before? Or you're just like, well, yeah, I guess I am kind of good at that.
No, I think moving around and just meeting all these different people and stuff growing up that kind of developed. And I never thought about it at that point till actually I got into the field of it and said, many people, you know, training officers and different things go, man, you really have the gift for gab and being able to connect and communicate with people and, you know, talk my way out of more than one fight, you know, just being able to
right
talk people down and go, you know, let's do this different, you know.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you had to change gears a lot growing up.
Oh yeah.
And even it's all in the U.S., but definitely different cultures everywhere.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you had to kind of get with that.
Yep.
So you got it on a tip that you might be good at something.
Yep.
And so did that cause you at that time to work your way really towards police or law enforcement, like in earnest?
Yeah, that was an immediate flip for me at that okay. point. It was literally my first ride along I did was for the little town I went to high school in just north of Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Saturday night, and it was back when the TV show Cops was real popular.
Remember, yeah.
And this was a small little town. Nothing was going on, and we had an alarm call at one of the local schools. And so it was wide open all the way around it. So the officer was just driving around the school, and he let me out. And I'm checking doors for him as he's just kind
of... hand you a revolver and like...
Yeah, no gun. Just go pull on that door for me.
Yeah.
And then we got done with that call, and it was close to 8 o'clock on Saturday night. So he had some paperwork to do. So he parks the car, puts a little portable TV on the dashboard, and we watched Cops while he wrote his report.
Really?
And that was really the only call for the day, you know, on that. But I was like, man, this has so much potential. Because you never know what you're going to do. You know, it's not a mundane job at all. You don't know what's going to happen.
No, you're largely responsive.
Yeah, from right? minute to minute.
Yeah, it's whatever stroll comes across the waves, or however you want to say it.
And that was intriguing to me, along with that team environment that you develop from sports and football. And
yeah, that is a big loss of quitting sports is that kind of all those guys.
Yep.
Aren't there?
Yeah. And even when you leave, you know, law enforcement, you know, it's same thing. There's like this void there.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
So you did the ride along. How old were you on that ride along?
I was 18.
Okay. So you did that, and that kind of further set the hook. Like, it wasn't, didn't discourage you.
No, that night was it. That set the hook on me. And then, you know, I had some other ride alongs that were a lot more exciting than that. You know, so you got to see the other side of it, and yeah.
And would you just go pound on the door at the police station? Like, how'd you get those rigged up?
I started taking night classes at a junior college there mm-hmm. for law enforcement while I was going to Sac State.
Okay.
They had a reserve officer program is basically what it was. Trying to just test the waters a little bit more, completed that, got hired on as a reserve officer for mm-hmm. a local agency outside Sacramento. And at the same time, back to the animal thing, I was thinking about law enforcement, combining that with animals and going into fish and game.
Okay.
So I went to the Fish and Game Academy, which was law enforcement accredited, but there was like an extra several weeks to go over all the fish and game
laws. Is that
laws.
Something you could do where you were living?
Yes.
Okay.
But at that time, there was a big hiring freeze at Fish and Game. And they were bringing a bunch of lateral officers over from, like, state parks and different things.
Consolidating it up a little bit.
Yeah. So that ruled me out for fish and game at the time. So I went conventional law enforcement and ended up working full-time for the agency I hired on as a reserve with.
Okay. So you were – let's talk about that. So were you – what city or township or municipality were you first started – when you first started? Maybe you were there the whole time, but where did you start
your career? A little town called Auburn, California.
And that's the one outside Sacramento?
Yeah, just west of Sacramento.
Okay, and were you there for your career?
No, I was there about 2 years, and then I moved to the Bay Area to Petaluma, California.
You did, okay. Yeah. And did you, we talked about this, did you start, I don't know the proper terminology, so you got to bear with me, but I'm going to say as a non-canine mm-hmm. police officer and then canine police officer, were you a canine handler from the jump, or is that something that came in along the way?
That came in along the way. You kind of have to earn the position for that and have opening for that. Auburn had a canine program. They had one canine officer. So as soon as I was able, I started working and training with him. And so I would be the dummy on taking bites from the dogs in the
with
bite
like
suit.
With like the pad and shit on?
Yeah. That's the way you start out. So
we got to see if this kid really wants this.
And that's exactly it. That is exactly it.
Yeah.
And so then when I transferred to Petaluma, it was the same thing. They had two dogs at the time. So I started training with them, getting in the bite suit, taking bites, and working with the dogs.
Bite suit, those are probably were homemade when you were doing that?
No, they were.
Or they were real things?
They were real things, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we gotta jump down in this canine. Okay, so I see canine police officers walking around malls. Mm-hmm. I see them, I was at Six Flags last summer. Saw one at the entrance. I actually sniffed out a guy who was bringing some weed into the place or something like that. So you see them around. Every once in a while you see them fly down the highway past you. We know the stories that we see about guys who are in the military probably doing, you know, similar functions.
Yep.
So let's back up with what is the canine unit? What are you doing when you have your canine? When someone shows up, what is the role of you as a canine handler? Like what is you and your dog as a team? What do you guys do?
That really depends on what you're getting involved in.
Okay. Highest possible level to smell things, attack things.
Yes. So it depends on the dog and what they're trained for, cross-trained. You can have dual-purpose dogs that are trained for protection work and then also narcotics or bomb. You can have just a protection dog. You can have just a bomb or just a drug dog. It just depends on the personality of the dog and what your goal is.
Okay.
Ours were dual-purpose protection and narcotics trained.
Protection. Give me an example of a protection scenario.
They would do apprehension, protect the handler. If we could send them
through apprehension. Okay, that's what I was trying to clear out. Like, who are we protecting? So they, because in my head, and this is the wrong terminology, in my head I'm thinking, okay, that's an attack dog at your command. Meaning like they are, which is protecting you.
Correct.
But is it fair? Is that almost taboo to say? Is that so wrong it's taboo to say? Or can I think of it that way and it'd be fair?
From a outside view, absolutely. You could see that as an attack. The dogs are trained that this is fun. This is a game for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like throwing a ball.
Really?
Yeah. This is all about just being fun. You know, if it wasn't fun for them, they wouldn't want to do it and they wouldn't be so good at it. So it's really just encouragement and build up and making this a fun game for them. Now, there are aspects of protection work that require a tough dog because sometimes if you're apprehending a suspect, they'll turn and fight with the dog and do different things like that. So you want a hard dog that's going to fight through that.
Mm-hmm. They like to have a lot of fun.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
So, but the initial training and all that is, you know, like from a puppy, you're having them bite and hold like a towel and you're playing tug of war with them and giving them commands. So it's a game. It's just being fun.
So you have protection dogs,
mm-hmm.
you have narcotics dogs, you have explosives. Did you say explosives?
Yep.
Explosives. What other category is there?
Oh gosh, there's
is it, it's a lot.
Yeah. If you get into search and rescue, you know, you have, you know, people that find cadavers, you know, dead people, trained to find people over water, over certain circumstances, you know, with natural disasters and terrorist attacks and different things. You know, you have a lot of these search and rescue dogs that are in rubble trying to locate people that are alive, and then other dogs are coming in afterwards trying to, you know, do the recoveries. It's just, they're amazing animals. And so it's just.
Do you remember any moments when you were, you'd been around dogs? I mean, if for no other reason, you grew up in the U.S. and they're dogs.
Yeah.
We all have dogs.
We always had dogs growing up.
And, but that moment you're like, holy shit, they are really good at this. Like, do you have a moment where like you tried to challenge the dog with like a, hey, here's, smell these clothes, and you wouldn't hit him or something? And you're like, holy shit, I can't believe that dog just did that.
Yeah, one of my dog specialties was tracking,
okay.
And we did probably a 2-3 mile track one night on some suspects that had stolen a car.
This was a live thing.
This was
wasn't
alive.
A practice.
Yeah, no, this wasn't practice. This was live.
Okay.
And we end up apprehending them, but it was just like, my God, we went this far
just by sniffing sidewalks and or whatever.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing.
2 miles a long distance.
Yeah. I used to be in shape then because we'd have to run when he was on the track.
But for what it's worth, I think of you in shape right now.
No.
You were still in shape.
Around shape.
So had you not had the dog with you, would that have occurred that night? Would you have found them?
No.
No other way?
No. That's unless we had a helicopter or something up. But yeah.
You didn't have
but
that
we
support
didn't have that,
that
support,
night.
No.
Okay. So that those people get away at least for that night. Had, I don't know the whole story, but at least presumably that night they would have gotten
right.
away.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So when you started working with the dogs, did you have to learn how to train? Or is this something that came innate? I mean, there's probably at this point a fairly formulaic way to train dogs,
yes.
I would assume?
Yeah. In order to be a canine handler, you had to be certified. So we had a 10-week training course that we worked with the dog specifically. Learned all the different techniques from, you know, obedience and the bite work and narcotics detection and, you know, everything that we were working on doing. Get certified through the state, you and your dog, because your dog has to pass qualifications as well.
These are literally partners.
Yes. Yep.
And you classified as a team? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. that was my buddy. He went home with me every night.
Oh,
you
my
know.
God. That's high-risk stuff because
yeah.
you start to love it
oh,
so
yeah.
much.
Yeah. Best job I ever had.
So it is not at all what you're describing to me is not what kind of I think maybe people joke about, but maybe I think of these dogs, their training is really rough and tough. Here's like this piece of meat and, you know, hitting them with a stick or something like that. So it's not like this horrible, awful. It probably can be, but you guys aren't doing sort of, you said it's more of a game-oriented.
It's game. It's fun for them. You know, you do test them with certain aspects. You know, you challenge them.
Get ready for the job.
Yeah. But 95% of it is all fun. You know, if it becomes an abusive environment for them, then they're not going to want to perform. So.
Yeah, and they're just, like, attacking or protecting out of – I guess they wouldn't be protecting at that point. Maybe they would be attacking.
Yeah.
Just kind of out of rage.
Yep, absolutely.
And not thinking as clearly as they otherwise might have been. So talk attack dogs for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we see German Shepherds a lot.
Yep.
Now is – and you had German
– I had a Belgian Malinois.
Okay, Belgian, which I maybe could confuse for like a part German Shepherd. They have similar kind of features to a degree.
Yeah.
Like their ears. And
they have a similar head structure.
Yeah.
Malinois tend to be a little smaller than the Shepherds. And their body coat is a little different. Shepherds still have the dark brown and the black and all that. The standard Malinois is more of a lighter tan or a tan kind of body. And they'll just have the black muzzle, black mask on their face.
Well, so I was thinking, I think I see German Shepherds a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of more of a branded thing where, like, oh, you just get a German Shepherd? Or because I've had boxers,
mm-hmm.
and boxers seem like really well designed for that. Like, they were boar hunting dogs.
Right.
They're very strong, and they like to have a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And they also are physical.
Yes.
And so I'm thinking, why would that dog be better than that dog? Now I'm like, well, maybe a boxer can't smell like that dog. Maybe it doesn't have the endurance of that dog or whatever it is. But what are these physical or mental characteristics that make a German Shepherd or the Belgian, like, prime for this type of work?
I think that just goes back from eons of training, you know, all of them. Most of the dogs that you see in law enforcement and military are herding-type dogs for the protection, at least. And I think it's just kind of bred in their nature. They're also extremely intelligent. I mean, if you've ever looked at a German Shepherd in the eyes or even a Malinois, it's like there's something going on back there all
right.
the time, you know?
It's not like hanging out with a cow.
Right. You know, so they're always thinking and troubleshooting and, you know, trying to figure things out. So it has to do with the intelligence and just some of the natural instincts of the herding abilities and just, you know, some of their
So like a boxer being primarily having been bred for hunting,
mm-hmm.
that's a different enough mentality maybe versus a herding dog.
Yes, absolutely.
And they were used, you probably maybe know more about all these histories than I do. But for instance, World War One, a boxer was used. They put spools of cable on their back.
Yep.
And they ran it from trench to trench. Now, maybe every dog they get their hands on was doing that. so I don't know if that was a boxer special thing. German Shepherds, I'm assuming of German origin, Belgian, sort of France, Germany over there, doing the same sorts of things.
Right.
Were they working dogs in that respect, do you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the Malinois, you know, German Shepherds have been around for hundreds of years. Same with the Malinois, actually. I forget what year it was. The Malinois are getting close to going extinct, and there was the breed was going away. And there was a scientist over in Belgium who loved the breed, and he started rebuilding the breed back in, I think, like the 1700s, 1800s, and reestablishing it.
Really? So he traced their genealogy.
Yep.
And whatever else ology he had to study
yep.
to reconstruct them.
Yep.
Is that when the Belgian Malinois became a thing?
Yeah, I'd say more so over there. And they started getting back into the herding, you know, with the farms and different aspects of that life. It probably wasn't until probably the 90s that you really started seeing the Malinois in the U.S. and where they started importing them in for protection, military work, law enforcement stuff.
So outside of the law enforcement world, what do you think are like the three best breeds?
Oh, man. That just depends on what you're looking for, what you want.
Just a buddy.
Just a buddy. You can never go wrong with a lab as far as just a buddy. I mean, they're good family dogs generally. You know, they're just kind of a...
Buddy, what are we doing today?
Yeah, pretty much. Honestly... Probably the best dog you'll ever find is some mixed breed at a pound that just needs some love.
Right.
That's probably your best family dog you'll ever find.
They've been over-engineered and they want to be part of the family.
Yeah, that is probably your best dog.
Is there such a thing, we hear these things, but is there such a thing as a breed being sort of too inbred? Is that a thing for real?
Oh, yeah, and they'll start having health problems and stuff, you know, correlate to that, but
they do okay because the relations are getting a little too familial.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Right? All these guys really look a lot alike, and they're dying really young.
Yes.
Type of thing. Yeah. I mean, you take a dog like a boxer, which is you look at if we're saying everything comes from a wolf, is that still the prevailing?
I think that's the prevailing thought at this point.
Yeah. So if that's the case. A boxer is pretty far from that.
Yes.
Yeah, at least from muzzle structure and
yep.
everything like that. That's a lot of deliberate breeding going on there.
Correct.
To get those shapes.
Yeah. I mean, down to the little pugs and the chihuahuas and, you know, so yeah.
I mean, how are those even related to a wolf? I mean, the amount of iterations you would need.
Right.
I mean, that's like penicillin. Someone fucked up and made a pug. You know, and they're like, you nailed it.
Exactly.
You know, people like these things. Okay, so we got SWAT. You said this word SWAT earlier, and we kind of looked at that. So you were working, the canine handler can be brought in or kind of flow in and out of SWAT situations.
Correct.
Is that right? So you guys are sort of available as this unit that can tack on. Correct. Show up to respond.
Yep.
Are there any incidences or and how was that time when you were SWAT? I mean, that's a pretty well-tuned group.
Yeah, there's a lot of training together that went with that. You know, that was, you know, just like any team really, you know, trained and get yourself better and better. Canine tend to be kind of boring on SWAT call-outs. A lot of times you're sitting on rear perimeter, laying in the cold, waiting for somebody to come out, you know, in case somebody ran out the backside.
Trying not to fall asleep kind of thing.
Yeah. It was great, you know, if it was cold because I could cuddle up my partner and my backup sitting there is freezing their butt off, you know. Can I cuddle with your dog? No, you can't.
No, that's weird.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
But, outside of that, you know, if we were making entry or something, you know, depending on the situation, sometimes SWAT team would make initial entry, and sometimes we send the dog in first, just kind of depending on scenarios.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't even talk about the idea of, you know, these dogs ever getting hurt in the line of duty. I know it happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully that's not an experience that hopefully you guys got out. I know you mentioned that you got injured, and I don't even want to bring it up because I know how close you guys get to the dogs, but these dogs do get injured and so forth.
They
and
do.
That's just part of something. It's kind of like getting a dog just for your family. You know, you hope you outlive it, but you really don't ever want to have to deal with it not being there.
Yeah. I was fortunate when I got hurt. My dog was old enough. I bought him from the city and kept him.
So, oh, you did?
So, yeah. So I kept him till through his life.
Yeah, natural.
Yeah.
I didn't realize the city would own the dog.
Yes. City would buy it. Yep.
Interesting. Now you've got a really well-trained dog. They make money off you? You trained it and you had to pay back your own training?
I bought him for $1.
$1?
Yeah, just so there was some exchange there, but yeah.
Yeah, how do you even value something like that?
Yeah.
Anyway, so you did law enforcement for a total of how many years?
About 10.
10 years. And you got injured, and you had to hang up your hat.
Yes.
Eventually. when you did do that, were you ready to – were you kind of like – I feel like I've run my course here and I can
–
or
no.
Were you like, no, I was ready to keep going.
I was ready to keep going. I was completely lost when that happened.
How did you get injured? Was it on the – like in work or did you fall down your own steps?
No, I fell down a friend of mine's steps helping
him
move. Yeah, screwed my back up. Yeah, so.
Remember that line in My Cousin Vinny? Did you ever see that?
Oh, I love that movie.
When he's like, I fell down a flight of steps. He goes, yours or someone else's?
Yeah.
He goes, mine. He goes, fuck.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't even help you with that.
Yeah.
So you got hurt not working. You were helping a friend out for a six pack of beer or something lame like that.
Helping him move, something stupid.
And it didn't, you know, accident happens. You hurt your back and then you had to go through all that rigmarole.
Yes.
And so you came to the conclusion or your body told you that you need to go do something else.
Yeah, kind of was lost and had no option but to go do something else at that point.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were kind of back at the drawing board. You at least had your dog with you.
Yep, I did have that.
At the drawing board. And so tell me about that time. I know that you said you were kind of like, okay, I gotta rebuild here, which I get that, so I don't have to drag through all of that. But what did you view as kind of on the table?
I had no clue at that point. I was, you know, hindsight being 20/20, I had no forethought beyond what I was law enforcement at the time. So I kind of felt around trying to figure out another path with different things. Went to work for an Indian casino, ran their showroom for all their concerts, did professional lights and sound with them for a little bit, went into compliance, doing internal audit work with them. Absolutely hated it.
Not your thing.
Not my thing. Concert stuff was kind of cool with the lights and all that, but and the sound, but that's a tough life too, so I didn't want to.
Is that a night job?
Yeah, that's almost solely a night job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how long did you do? When you were doing that, were you feeling like I'm doing this until I figure out what I want to do? Or, I mean, is that how you had it in your head? Because how long did it take to realize I like doing stuff during the day?
I don't know. It was just one of those, you just kind of like get in a rut. You know, of course, that was my career path. You know, my education, everything I was doing was geared towards staying in law enforcement. So I was just kind of lost, feeling my way out,
you know,
depressed and everything else.
Yeah,
going.
The whole nine.
Yeah, lost my team, you know, that whole thing again.
Yeah.
Start over. So just reaching for straws, started the casino.
You got busy. Yeah.
Yeah, just get yourself busy again. And while I was rehabbing my injury and all that, you know, and then absolutely hated it. And then my dad, he was in the Sacramento area still at the time, and he had got hurt in construction, and he got out selling real estate, and then his broker screwed him over out of a bunch of money one year. He called me up and said he was going to have to go back on his tools.
Yeah, okay.
Said, I'll get you in the union over here, and let's start as a welder fitter.
So it lined up. The timing lined up.
Yeah, it did.
And, you know, that sounds like for me, like I would have kind of really like the opportunity to pair up with my old man and go do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully that was kind of, I guess it occurred because you guys had the relationship to be able to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, we did. And it was great. I mean, I worked around a lot of people over the years and managed a lot of people. And I will tell you, hands down, my dad is probably one of the best welders and pipe fitters I've ever been around.
Seriously?
So, yeah, he was brilliant. So
he has 10,000 hours in?
Plus.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's a good teacher.
Yeah, he was.
What kind of teacher was he? Was he the kind of guy just turn you loose with scraps and let you kind of figure it out? Or?
No, he was a little more hardcore than that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He was still
old school.
I
thought I was going to be wrong.
But. Yeah, he was still old school, you know.
That's how you do it.
Yeah. Because in pipe fitting, you use a lot of trigonometry.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't studied trig in years.
So Katoa?
Yeah.
That's all you need to know, right?
So he was, and I have a sister that's 20 years younger than me, an oops, and she was in school at the time, and I remember sitting there, like, day one of the job with my dad looking, trying to figure something out, and a simple mathematical, you know, trig equation, and he's like, what are you doing? I go, I'm trying to remember how to do this shit. And he's like,
trying to get fucking better.
Yeah, he's like, and that's what he said. He goes, what the fuck? He goes, I got to teach you how to, again, he goes, I'm teaching your sister how to do this shit now, and I got to teach you how to do it. And I'm like, do you want to yell at me or just tell me how to do it and refresh my memory?
Yeah, is this the curriculum?
Yeah.
Do you fucking first berate me?
Yeah.
And then we'll get down to it?
Yeah.
And I guess that was his way.
That was his way, yeah.
Okay.
And then as I started learning and becoming more confident, you know, we kind of got rid of the dad-son relationship, and it was more of a team partnership. So there was still a lot of knockdown, drag out arguments over stuff. But
yeah, he wasn't as like, he was still a dick, but not as frequently.
Yeah, pretty much. Thing. Yeah.
That's a win.
Yeah, it was. It was.
You know, that's a battle of inches, really.
It is. Yeah.
How long did you guys work together doing that?
Oh, God. Probably 7 or 8 years.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
How many fights on average per week? I mean,
At least one or two.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're looking at a good amount of fights.
Yeah, I'd say arguments, but
yeah, I mean, nothing physical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
heated arguments. Discussions.
Yes. Yeah. Then there were times, you know, like he'd be set up as a foreman, and I'd be working for him, and there were times he was working for me, and one time he got pissed off at me and quit. And, you know, so
is that what you do, Dad? You're a quitter?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, the tables had turned.
Yeah, my superintendent goes, your dad quit. I go, yeah. He's like, what are you going to do? I go, let him quit.
Like, he's got to learn these lessons.
Yeah, basically. And he's like, I'm going to get him back, you know. So he called my dad and begged him to come back. And
seriously?
Yeah.
Wow, that's an interesting. You'd never been in that position with him before.
No, never.
That's crazy. And you've got it. So, are your kids older than one of your kids older than your sister?
No.
Okay.
No, I started late.
Okay.
I didn't start having kids until I was in my 30s.
Okay. All right. So she's got about 10 years on him.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know if we had like an inversion.
Yeah,
going
no.
on, where. Aunt, whomever is younger. So moving right along. So you're working pipe fitting with your dad. You're doing that for 7, 8 years, something like that. And that concludes. Or did somebody, again, did you get a tip from a trusted friend that you could go do something? Or where'd you go from there?
It, just working in the construction industry, you know, trying – No, you know, what I was taught was doesn't matter if you like it or not, just try to be the best at what you're doing.
Right.
So just that mentality.
Is that the same thing as don't overthink it?
Sometimes I think it is overthinking it, but, you know, just analyze. I mean? Yeah.
I just get the shit done kind of thing.
It's a lot of that degree. Yeah. But just be not just get it done, but get it done right. Get it done well. Take pride in what you're doing.
As long as I'm going to be here, I might as well be the best at it.
Exactly. If my name's on it, let's make it the best.
Yeah. That resonates.
Yeah. So that's what I was kind of taught growing up. So.
Yeah.
Just.
Well, it's also, I think it's kind of who you are. I mean, my experience in life is that there are people who give a shit and people who don't.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's like. When it comes to like the wiring diagram, that's like you're really high up in the circuitry, you know, where like There's just kind of broad classifications.
Yeah. If you ask my wife, there's some shorts up there, but.
Well, you know, not all systems are designed to do all things.
This is true.
You know, but yours is geared to do that.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that, yeah, I think it's an unfair comment to say there are two types of people, but I think it's a broad stroke that's relatively applicable.
Yeah. I would say, you know, definitely people with drive and people with less drive. So
yeah, I would say barring all relevant detail, it's totally true.
Yeah.
Yeah, barring anything to the contrary. So you're just getting busy now. And what year did you start with your old man doing this?
2001, two, somewhere in there.
Okay, so plus or minus 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, and then so you guys are doing this. So it was like 2008-ish.
Yep.
Is when you guys part ways, not good, bad, or otherwise, but something else comes up?
Yep.
Okay, so what did you start doing?
Well, I was a general foreman on a power plant we were building out of my local. The company I was working for, after we completed it, asked if I would come on as a piping superintendent for them, doing the scrubber systems on the coal-burning plants out in Illinois. So I left California, came out to Illinois, started doing that. And that wasn't actually the end of my dad and I. He actually came out and worked for me out here for a while as well.
Did he really?
So, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But yeah.
So you both got poached.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how long were you out here in Illinois doing that?
Started in 2007 up in Havana, Illinois. Worked at the power plant there and then came down to Baldwin and worked on the three units there.
And so when you say working on, you're pipe fitting, you're welding, you're...
At that point, I'm the superintendent, so I'm managing the field guys, taking care of the budgets, monitoring the cost on, you know, my portion of the job, kind of like a project manager over my section of it.
Writing. Okay, so you are overseeing the work.
Yeah.
At that point, yep. You've had an opportunity to... Hang up the welding mask.
Yes. Yeah.
Another thing we hung up. Hung up the welding mask, and now you're kind of in the, what they may say is a management at this point?
Early management, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're managing and probably wishing you were still welding.
There are definitely days where I'd go in and ask, can I just grind on this piece of pipe for a little bit?
Well, management's great until people get involved.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
You know, a kind of, you know, that changes things.
It does.
But you grew into it.
Yeah, you know, I think, again, kind of going back to the law enforcement stuff, you know, skills you learn as far as being able to manage people and read people and understand them and try and look at things through different perspectives, you know, helps with a lot of that. So
you had kind of a good toolkit for this.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Going into it.
Yeah.
And so you've been in management since that time. So we're talking 07, 08-ish.
Yep.
Right. So you've been in the management world. Doing that.
Correct.
And so we're in St. Louis now, and you were in Illinois. And then so you've ended up in St. Did Gross Mechanical bring you to St. Louis, or you'd already been here?
No, I still live in Illinois. I live in Edwardsville area.
Okay.
But
you guys just put amazing baseball fields out there.
Yes, we did.
Holy shit. We played there. So the kids play for Redbirds here.
Okay.
You know?
Yep.
And so we had, not to interrupt you or anything.
No, you're good.
But we had... you know, you should play. Eurekas are amazing. I don't know if you've seen those. Where we play our practice at Fenton, which is, I guess I can see why we practice there. We don't want to spend our money on the best practice facility, but our home field's out in Chesterfield, you know, right out by Spirit.
Yep.
I thought those were really nice. And then we're like, see on the schedule, we got a game in Edwardsville. And I'm like, you know. What field? I didn't even know you had field. They must be like relatively like a year old or something.
Right at that, probably.
I mean, it looks like somebody just ran a fucking vacuum over that outfield. I mean, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
It looks like I would have expected to see Arnold Palmer there and not an outfielder. They are really that good.
Yeah, now they're putting hotels and stuff up over there to bring some tournaments and stuff in. They're doing a big expansion on that park.
Are they?
Yeah.
So they've got, are they hoping to bring in higher, I mean, it's not just for 10-year-olds?
Yeah, I don't know totally what the game plan is there, but they're putting in a big like looks like a Top Golf, but I think it's just a driving range. And
okay, no shortage of land.
Yeah, no shortage of land there. Putting in some hotels. They just put in a bunch of pickleball courts and different stuff there as well. So
wow, yeah. I mean pickleball now covering the whole age range now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that was amazing because you kind of turned the corner on this thing, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of just cornfields, right? It was very country.
Yeah.
And then you come around and you got stadium lights and, you know, you've got like the chain link fences that are, you know, nicely painted. They're not just sort of the galvanized stuff. Yep. And you're like, wow.
Yeah.
And our kids were like, when you step on that field, you kind of like, is it okay if I step on? It was so nice. In fact, I was like, asked the coach if I go out there and like play catch for a few minutes. I wanted to be like on the field. But anyway, not to interrupt you,
no,
but that's
good.
A fabulous. But I'll say these other fabulous places all have one thing in common that all need to be upgraded: the concession stand.
Agreed.
I mean, there's room to improve there.
Yes, there is.
My advice, which will never be asked for, would be we don't need all 30 fields. Build 29 of them and save some budget so I can have a hot dog that I don't like throw up in the trash can 25 minutes later.
Yes.
But that's my two cents. So anyway, you're living over in Edwardsville.
Yeah.
And so you've been in the area for a long time
now. Yes. Yeah.
And so you've taken all this experience, and how did you and Gross Mechanical find one another?
So I was working for another contractor as a project manager here in the St. Louis area. One of the guys that was working for me, one of the local pipe fitters, he was my general foreman on a project, left and went to Gross to be their writing boss. And at that time, Gross was in need of a operations manager. So he recommended me for the job.
Really?
So.
Did you know that recommendation was going to occur?
No, I had no clue.
Good, you never had to get your hopes up.
Yeah, I mean, he asked me if I would be interested in it, and I said I was actually happy where I was. I wasn't even looking for anything, but I was like, you know.
Isn't that how it goes?
Yeah, I'll entertain, you know, a promotion.
Yeah, everything's for sale.
So, yeah, so they talked to Brad, the owner, and it fit. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
And so you're COO over there currently.
Yes.
And have you been a COO before?
This is my first run at it. So
it is. So what are your thoughts at this point?
Absolutely love it.
Okay.
Absolutely love it. Yeah. I tell you, the Gross family, Brad and his brother Michael, I've never worked with or for two better people. They're phenomenal people.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
They really are. They've got the right balance of sort of levity, like about humor, but also dead serious and staying focused. So they keep it in mind as the days go by.
Yeah.
But these are humans around us and not anything else but that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, wonderful people.
That's great. So in kind of closing, there was something you mentioned before we started talking, just sort of in passing, that we must talk about, uh-oh, which is you're a certified hypnotist.
Correct.
What the fuck is that all about? Like, where'd that come from? Like, whole story. Like,
God. So back to Sacramento.
Am I currently hypnotized?
No.
Okay.
No.
I'm good.
Years ago, I was at the California State Fair in Sacramento. I'd never seen a hypnotist.
Like, what year are we talking?
Oh, God. This would have been 2003, 4 maybe. And they had a stage show, hypnotist going. And I sat and I watched the show, thought it was absolutely hysterical. But I went, this is a bunch of bullshit. This is all staged.
Sure.
But that guy, it was so funny. The guy that was doing the show, the hypnotist, was doing an adult version of his show.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a ticket, went to the show, laughed my ass off.
Because they had hypnotized them and stuff?
Oh, they'd hypnotized a whole group of people.
I wonder if I saw this. I mean, there are probably many of them.
They do them all over the place, yeah.
Okay, I've seen something like this, and it's funny as shit.
Yeah. But I'm like, this is bullshit, though. This is all staged.
Staged, yeah. So, I've been wondering that since I saw it in like 1998 or whenever that was.
So the next year, I'm back at the state fair again, and they had another stage show going, different hypnotists. So I sat down, was watching the show, and there was two teenage girls in front of me, and one of them got selected to go up on stage.
Okay.
And after the show,
when she got selected, did you feel like that was a stage selection at that moment?
I wasn't sure. Yeah, it was. They both looked pretty shocked. So if they were doing it,
they're good. Okay.
But when she came back and her friend starts questioning her, I'm eavesdropping on the conversation.
Had to.
Yeah. And, you know, back to law enforcement, being able to read people and stuff.
You were working.
I'm working. Yeah. And I'm listening and I'm watching. And I'm like, this girl legitimately doesn't know what she just did.
Without question.
And I'm like, maybe there's way more to this than I thought there was. So me being me, something intrigues me.
I dug in.
And I started digging and got on a forum. And I was working in Reno at the time and met this old guy who's a retiring hypnotist. He kind of took me under his wing.
It's like the Karate Kid.
It is. It was. I'm like Daniel's son here, yeah. You know. And he kind of took me under his wing and taught me and showed me what it was about. And you know, the therapeutic side of it, not just the comedy side of it, and the benefits of it and different things you can do. And
wait, so you saw this, realized that this was very likely legitimate.
Yep.
And you seeked out somebody to learn more.
Yes.
Did you know what you wanted to learn? Were you like, I want to know how to do this? Or you're like, just, I want to unravel. I want to understand.
I just want to unravel it and understand it.
Okay.
And then as I got into that, I'm like, all right, I want to learn how to do this.
Really?
And then, after that, I went and got certified in it, and then just kind of did it on the side for friends and family over the years.
Wait, hold on. So you saw the show, you saw the girl, you were convinced, and that, like, were you convinced that hypnotism, or you were convinced something had occurred that she didn't know had occurred?
I was convinced something had occurred that she didn't know had occurred.
And it was maybe hypnotism that did it.
Yes. But I didn't understand what it was or how it worked or the processes behind it, the science behind it. And so that's what I was really starting to delve into.
So you found Miyagi.
I did.
And at some point, you must have gone in there at some point as a Doubting Thomas, right?
Yeah.
And so when did you sort of be like, this shit's real?
The first time he put me under.
Oh, yeah. Really? Was that day one? Or was that?
No, it was a couple meetings into it, you know, what he was telling me about it. And he goes, you just need to experience it.
What is under mean?
So with hypnotism, what it is like, there's two parts of your brain, or call it the conscious and the subconscious or the unconscious mind.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about the conscious mind as like your filter. So all your life experiences, you're growing up, all your perceptions that you've developed over the years goes through the conscious mind. Mm-hmm. So as we're sitting here talking now, your conscious mind's analyzing what I'm telling you, if it's bullshit or not,
sure,
based on your experiences.
Okay.
Now your subconscious or unconscious mind is that's the powerhouse of the brain. That's where everything happens. So
can I think of it as like the primal part of the brain?
Yeah. So your heart beating, you don't have to think about making your heart beat, but that's your subconscious mind.
So autonomic is part of it, but not all of it.
Correct.
Okay.
So with hypnosis, what you do is, why people appear to be asleep, is you put the conscious mind to sleep through relaxation or various different techniques so you can speak directly to the subconscious mind.
Holy shit.
So during hypnosis, even though you appear to be asleep, you're actually hyper aware.
Like, so if someone's hypnotized, is this like an eyes closed situation?
Generally.
Are they like sitting there zombied?
No, generally you have them close their eyes. Depends on what you're doing. If it's a comedy routine or if you're doing therapeutic stuff, you know, you want them to be completely relaxed, eyes closed, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But comedy routine, you know, there's various things you can do. So
you're turning off the filter,
mm-hmm,
and all the biases.
Correct. Yep.
That are, and the hope being that you can just get right down to the root of this,
yep,
situation.
Yep.
Is that why somebody there are millions of reasons, I suppose, somebody would want to be hypnotized for therapeutic reasons? Yeah. But I would imagine there is a high level, which is you're trying to unpack something that is just so auto-filtered that you can't get to it. Like, they don't even know that they're, even though it's part of their conscious behavior, it's just so sewn in.
Yeah. And it really depends on what you're working with on them. Like, one of the specialties I do is pain management. Kind of touched my grandfather, my dad's dad. He passed of cancer years ago now, but he was a very religious gentleman. Never drank alcohol, never did any drugs in his life. He was a submariner in World War II. He was in charge of all the alcohol that fueled the torpedoes because he didn't drink it, and he would protect it from the crew. That kind of guy.
You had a hen watching the hen house.
Yeah. So he refused to take any of the pain medication when he was going through chemo and battling the pain. And this was before I
was hypnotist. He's like, I've come this far.
Yeah. And, you know, conversations like, he's in hospice, you're dying. Why don't you, like, not be in pain? He goes, I'm not taking that shit.
I don't roll like that.
Man. Yeah. And he stood fast, you know, till his last minute. And so I'd always wished that there was something that I could have done to help him.
The non-medicinal.
Yeah, get out of that pain.
Wow.
And so when I found hypnosis, I was like.
It's like a whole world.
Yeah, it's like a whole different world opened up. So, yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, does that imply that you can, through hypnosis, if the autonomic nervous system or functions are part of the subconscious mind.
Yes, you can change them.
You can turn things on or off.
Yes.
Bullshit. There's no way, really. Mm-hmm. So what's an example of something that you could sort of like rewire an autonomic pathway?
Well, I won't say autonomic, but like...
Or subconsciously.
Pain, as an example.
Okay.
You know, that's a sensation, that's an interpretation of a sensation that your brain is reading. So, you know, tickle, like as you get tickled, is technically a pain sensation. But through hypnosis, you can change how the brain perceives that sensation and lessen it, take it away.
Seriously.
Yeah.
See, I believe in hypnosis, by the way, so I'm like totally leaning in more because I think this stuff is so interesting.
Yeah.
And have you ever done it? I mean, it's not what you do for a living. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting the reps that somebody else might be getting who's doing it, you know, 8 hours a day, every single day of their life.
Right.
But have you had opportunity to do this with somebody and had an opportunity to help them?
I actually have a business on the side that is called Life Enhanced Hypnosis that I do. I have a little office in O'Fallon that I treat people.
Seriously?
Yeah.
This is unbelievable. This is a whole nother episode, but what do you enjoy the most out of it today? I mean, I know that it's, so my wife became she has a doctorate in physical therapy, got that because what happened to one of her grandparents. So like,
right.
This happens, you know, these things occur you know, the reason she got into it is unshakable and will always be there. But what do you love about doing it today?
Honestly, it's the helping people.
Okay.
You know, that's the drive for me. I charge a fee, you know, to cover, you know, some rental and stuff, but
yeah,
I don't do it to make money off of it. I just to help people.
Man, if someone walks in there in pain and walks out without pain, you probably could have doubled your fee. But I know that's not why you're doing it.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, my point in saying that is they aren't feeling like you got to, you know, fleece them in any way if they're walking out having covered some cost.
Yeah. I had a lady, this is last, I saw her a couple, 3 years ago now, I guess. She came in, when she was a child, had been in a car wreck with her parents and had been in excruciating pain her whole life. And they tried all sorts of different stuff to alleviate the pain, surgeries, different things. And she came in because she was wanting to try something different, like a workout program, something like that, to
shake it up
and help alleviate the pain. And but she wanted, was there for hypnosis for motivation to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And got so my first thing sitting down with her is I do a consultation before we do anything and try and just figure out what the root cause of all this stuff is. And as we're talking about this, I'm like, well, why don't we just get rid of the pain? To which she looked at me and just started sobbing.
Like, is that even possible?
Yeah, she's like, nobody has ever said that to me before. And I'm like, well, we can do all this stuff, but why don't we just help with the pain?
Yeah, let's get to it.
And we did a session, and 2 years later, she says she's still not in any pain. She walked out of that, out of the session that night feeling like she had never felt since she was a kid.
So from the moment you started doing that hypnosis that night to the point where you like clapped or whatever you did to bring her out, mm-hmm. how many minutes had elapsed?
About an hour.
An hour. Changed her life forever.
Yep.
That's a result.
And that's why I do it.
That's remarkable. You changed that person's life forever.
Yeah. That's the goal.
That's pretty solid.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to wrap us up on that high note because that's fabulous. But thank you very much for coming in today.
No, thanks for having me.
It's just been really fun to learn about you.
Yeah.
So thank you.
No, appreciate it.
All right.